I'm Matt Katz, a reporter at WNYC, in for Tanzina Vega this week. This is The Takeaway. We begin in the Middle East.
Each time Israel hears a foreign leader speak of its right to defend itself, it is further emboldened to continue murdering entire families in their sleep.
If you choose to avoid condemning Hamas, it will strengthen the radical terror group which aims to overthrow the Palestinian Authority and whose charter explicitly calls for wiping Israel off the map.
Sunday marked another deadly day in the conflict between Israel and Palestine. The violence has been raging for more than a week now, and so far in the Gaza Strip, the Israeli military has killed close to 200 people, including 58 children. Israel has also destroyed a number of tall buildings in Gaza City. Over the weekend, it leveled the building where the offices of the Associated Press and Al Jazeera were located. Israel argues that its airstrikes in Gaza are a defense against rockets fired by Hamas into Israeli neighborhoods. Palestinian militants have so far launched more than 3,000 rockets into Israel, according to the Associated Press. At least 10 people have been killed in Israel, including one child. But compared to the violence inflicted on the Palestinians by Israel, the toll has been disproportionate. On CBS on Sunday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said there isn't a clear end in sight to this conflict.
We're not going to just let them get away with it. Neither would you. I mean, you just imagine what would have happened if you had 2,900 rockets fired on Washington and New York and others. I think you would understand our position. I think you do, actually.
Joining me now is Vice News reporter Hind Hassan. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Hind.
Hi, thank you.
Also with us is Aaron David Miller, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Aaron, thanks for coming back on the show.
Pleasure, Matt.
Hind, you've been reporting from East Jerusalem. Can you just tell us what you're seeing on the ground right now?
Right. So we've been here for almost 3 weeks, actually. We came before it escalated to the level that is escalated now. And from the moment we arrived, we went to an area called Damascus Gate, which is it's kind of an entry point into the Al-Aqsa compounds and into the old city. And during Ramadan, which is when we arrived, a lot of Palestinians would go there and they would gather. And it's a spot where a lot of people socialize during this month. And Palestinians are allowed to travel from different areas of Palestinian territory to go there during this month, which they're not allowed to do in other months. So it's a very important time for the Palestinians in the region. And what happened was Israeli police tried to limit access into the Al-Aqsa compound and into the ground outside Damascus Gate where Palestinians gather. And that obviously upset and angered and distressed Palestinians. Protests began, and then there was a lot of police violence in response. And from the minute we got there, we saw police using stun grenades. We saw police using water cannons and skunk water, which has a really foul smell and can linger for days. We saw people being arrested. A number of them told us that they were children, 15 years old. The scenes were pretty shocking when we arrived. And then there were also things happening in different areas of East Jerusalem as well. So, for example, in Sheikh Jarrah, which is a neighborhood where there are Palestinian families who moved there after they were displaced by Israel in 1956, they are under threat from losing their homes because the Israeli courts are currently deciding whether to allow them to appeal to stay in their homes, as it is considered by settler organizations to belong to Jewish people. And this has also led to protests and, again, police aggression against Palestinians. And all of this kind of added together and accumulated and led to the situation that we have now. At the moment in East Jerusalem, where I am, it feels surreally, like very surreal and calm compared to what's happening in Gaza, for example. And that is because Hamas doesn't fire rockets really into East Jerusalem, and also, you know, Israel doesn't bomb East Jerusalem. So we're kind of here in a safe place, and desperate as journalists to get into Gaza because we want to speak to the people and witness what's happening. But the crossing into Gaza is currently closed by Israel. They're currently not allowing human rights organizations or medics, emergency workers and journalists to cross the Erez crossing into Gaza. So at the moment, we're kind of waiting with bated breath as to when the ceasefire will happen and when we'll be able to go in.
Aaron, I highlighted in the intro the rocket attacks by Hamas into Israel. There's Israeli airstrikes into Gaza, and just told us about the violence in Jerusalem. Can you tell us what's different about this particular conflict compared to various skirmishes we've seen between these two sides over the decades, and maybe then also what's familiar about it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to trivialize this. People are dying disproportionately. There's an asymmetry of casualties here, and there are reasons for that. It has a feel to some degree of a wash, rinse, and repeat cycle, 2008/9, 2012, and of course, 2014, in which the confrontation went on for 50 days. 67 Israeli soldiers were killed, 6 Israeli civilians, and depending on the stats, anywhere from 2,200 to 2,300 Palestinians, large numbers of Hamas fighters, but large numbers of civilians. Right now, I think you've got a certain ebb and flow to these conflicts. I think that, and they usually come to an end not as a consequence of external pressure, but when the two major protagonists, the IDF and the government of Israel and Hamas, decide that they've accomplished everything they're going to, and B, there's a risk, in essence, of losing the gains that they have achieved. We have not yet reached that point, tragically, and it really is a tragedy. The thing that makes this different, in addition to the multi-front nature of this, as Hind reported, you have serious escalation or have had serious escalation in Jerusalem. You've got, of course, the Israeli-Hamas mini confrontation. Some would call it deservedly a war. But it's the third element that strikes me as what's new, and that is the unprecedented communal violence within Israel between Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs. I do not believe, having looked at this across the last 70 plus years, that there's any precedent for what we've seen in half a dozen or more mixed Arab and Jewish communities and cities, where you have a degree of frustration on the part of Palestinian citizens of Israel, pulled by their Muslim Arab identity as a consequence of identification with what's happening in Jerusalem, Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the Sheikh Jarrah evictions, pulled by their desire to and their affinity, however different their circumstances are, with their co-religionists and across the Green Line, the Palestinians under Israeli occupation, and finally, most intriguingly, pulled by their identity as Israeli citizens, caught on one hand between a desire to integrate in Israeli society and yet suffering a degree of economic and social discrimination. It's stunning. At the same time, this horrible communal violence has taken place, exploited by criminal elements and by angry mobs of both Jews and Arabs. You have, for the first time in Israel's political history, the possibility, even now, of a small Arab party, the United Arab List, headed by Mansour Abbas, actually negotiating with Zionist parties to actually join an Israeli government. In fact, before the Hamas escalation, what they call the Change Coalition, the opposition to Benjamin Netanyahu, which spans left, right, and center, were very, very, very close to forming a government that would have included, for the first time, an Israeli Arab party, probably supporting the government from the outside. But it's the communal piece of this that is new, plus the intensity of the exchanges between the IDF and Hamas.
And where does this go? I mean, You have the possibility on one hand of there being, as Aaron said, a government coalition involving Arab Israelis, Palestinians by identity who are citizens of Israel. And yet, you know, this neighborhood, this area, these communities are both intertwined and at war at the same time. Is there a sense of how close a ceasefire could be, whether that's even plausible politically at this point, and what happens here?
First of all, absolutely what my colleague has just said, that is exactly the sense and the feeling and the conversation that is currently taking place in East Jerusalem, where we are amongst everyone that we're talking to, and especially Palestinians. And there are Palestinian journalists that we've spoken to who seem incredibly moved by what is happening now and really shocked, because unfortunately, with this conflict, there tends to be a lot of fatigue externally. And you find that when you try and talk to somebody about this conflict and say to them, you know, what's happening is important, people kind of roll their eyes and go, oh, you know, Israel, Palestine, that's always going on. But it really does feel different for people what they're witnessing in terms of this intercommunal violence. We went to Yaffa to witness a solidarity protest that was taking place there. And there were so many Palestinians from the area that had come out. The protest was very, very peaceful. But then we also have heard in different places, we've spoken to people about what is happening in the evening, and that sense of frustration that Palestinians are feeling that has come out as a result of so many different issues coming to the fore all at the same time. So the visions of the world watching as Israeli police and forces storm Al-Aqsa during the holiest days of Ramadan, the Sheikh Jarrah potential imminent forcible displacement of Palestinians who live there, and the images on social media that is coming out of police aggression and police violence. And it really put to the front this double standards that Palestinians say they have in how they're being treated by Israel and the Israeli court system as well. In terms of a ceasefire, we're in constant contact with people who are inside Gaza, with our colleagues inside Gaza. And honestly, in the first few days, there were rumors all over the place about, you know, there's potentially a ceasefire tonight, there's potentially a ceasefire tomorrow, there's going to be a ceasefire soon. And we've just not seen it happen. And from the conversations that we're having, the sense of dismay, frustration, anger and hurt from people inside Gaza who don't understand what's left to destroy. They've seen neighborhoods that they say, they tell us, are civilians who live there. One of the journalists that we're working with, his entire street, Al-Wahda Street, has had blocks all destroyed. And he was sending us some of the most gut-wrenching voice notes during that night of attacks. We did not know if he would survive. That's how scary it is for them right now. That's what he was saying to us on his voice notes. And when I asked him, I said, is there anything I can do? His response was, stop the war now. So we're hearing that the Israeli military has so-called goals that it wants to complete, and that it is nearing the end of completion of those goals. And so potentially there could be a ceasefire in the coming days. But for the people in Gaza, they're losing more hope as the days go along, because these rumors and conversations based on different nations that have come to negotiate keep coming in and out. And by the evening, they're still being bombed.
Aaron, as Hin mentioned, there's these negotiations with various parties involved. Officials from the U.S. and Egypt have been trying to negotiate a ceasefire. U.N. Security Council met yesterday but didn't take any action. You've been in rooms like this before, Aaron. What are these negotiations like? Do you have a sense of what they're talking about and where they might see a path to ending this thing?
Well, at the end of this, the real tragedy here is that as a consequence of all of this death and destruction, it's highly unlikely that anything positive is going to emerge. That's certainly the case with the last three rounds of Israeli-Hamas confrontation. The Israelis and Hamas have been indirectly negotiating a long-term ceasefire interim agreement, opening up Gaza in exchange for quiet. That has come to naught. The broader Israeli-Palestinian issue is so fundamentally broken by the toxic politics on both sides, the profound mistrust and lack of confidence, and the spectacularly Grand Canyon-like gaps which exist between Israelis and Palestinians on the core issues: refugees, borders, security, and of course, Jerusalem. Donald Trump argued that he had taken Jerusalem off the table. The fact is, if you look at the last month, you see that Jerusalem has become the table. That, I think, is the poignancy here. That in the end, we're going to be left with farther and farther away from any pathway to negotiate anything remotely resembling a conflict-ending agreement, between Israelis and Palestinians. You know, Woody Allen said that 90% of life, I think he said, is showing up. The reality is, in a negotiation, 90% of success is showing up at the right time. And the fact is, not until the two major protagonists believe, A, that they've accomplished everything they want to do, and B, that they risk losing what they've accomplished, will a ceasefire, probably delivered by Egypt, almost certainly delivered by Egypt, would ensue. I must say, as far as the Biden administration is concerned, they've low prioritized the Middle East, I would argue, understandably, given the fact that Biden confronts the greatest challenge of national recovery of any American president, probably since Franklin Roosevelt. Biden would argue to you that there's no single foreign policy issue out there anywhere in the world that poses a greater danger and threat to his presidency and the future of the American Republic than the four or five interlock crises that we face at the moment. And that view that I, Biden, want to be a transformational president at home because of the crises that now exist, but a smart but cautious risk-averse president abroad has forced him to pick his foreign policy spots very, very carefully. The Middle East is not one of them. His main priority there is not this issue. Frankly, I'm sure if you caught him at an honest moment, he'd say, make this thing go away. It's Iran that he's worried about, because you think this confrontation is bad. The prospects of an Iranian-Israeli confrontation over the nuclear issue, which could involve the United States, would be far more destructive and deadlier. So he is in no hurry to jump into this thing. The danger, however, and there's a certain amount of indifference on Biden's part here that concerns me. The real danger here in this drift is that you could end up with a mass casualty event. In 1996, in Grapes of Wrath operation, when the Israelis and Hezbollah were going at it, an errant Israeli artillery shell slammed into a UN compound at Qana. 100 people were killed. You get a Hamas rocket that willfully and intentionally, and they're looking for a spectacular way to end this, Hamas. You get one of those mass casualty events on Hamas's part against Israel, or alternatively, an Israeli drone strike or an artillery shell causes large numbers of casualties. It could paradoxically set the stage for an end, but at that moment, both sides are going to feel the need for even more retribution. And that's why it's critically important to bring this to an end now. And that is going to require on both sides a degree of pressure that has not yet been deployed, either on Israel by Washington or Hamas on the part of its supporters in the Arab world.
Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And Hind Hassan is a reporter for Vice News. Hind, be safe out there. Aaron, thanks so much for this context. Appreciate you both.
Thanks, you. Matt.
It's been more than a year since we were first told to mask up when going out in public, and it seems like we might just be able to start leaving those masks at home, if we're fully vaccinated.
Well, today is a great day for America in our long battle with coronavirus. Just a few hours ago, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and the CDC announced that they are no longer recommending that fully vaccinated people need wear masks.
That was President Joe Biden speaking on Thursday, celebrating the CDC's new guidance, which the agency's director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, announced earlier that day.
If you are fully vaccinated, you can start doing the things that you had stopped doing because of the pandemic. We have all longed for this moment when we can get back to some sense of normalcy.
The latest guidance comes less than 3 weeks after the CDC released milder recommendations, which relax the wearing of masks outdoors, and as vaccination efforts continue and COVID cases decline in the U.S. And while some are relieved by the CDC's announcement, others, including some public health experts, think the agency is moving too fast in easing mask recommendations. For more on this, we're joined by Dr. Megan Ranney, emergency physician and associate dean of the School of Public Health at Brown University. Dr. Ranney, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Matt. It's a joy to be here with you.
Oh, and it's a joy to have you. Thank you. So tell me, were you surprised by the CDC's decision to ease almost all masking for vaccinated people?
I think we were all surprised. I expected this relaxation to come, but I expected to hear it in about a month when a larger percentage of Americans are fully vaccinated. The science is clear that the vaccines are unbelievably effective, but we're still at only around 40% of Americans who have gotten both shots at this point. We're just not quite there yet.
So what happened? Why did the CDC make this decision? Any idea what the motivation was?
So I really do think that they were following the science. There were a few publications in the last couple of weeks that reinforced not just that these vaccines are tremendously effective in the real world. There were studies from other countries, from the US with healthcare workers, but also an accumulation of studies showing that even if you are one of the unlucky few to catch COVID after getting fully vaccinated, you're quite unlikely to spread it to others. And so I think from the CDC's perspective, this was the time to comment on the science. I think what is confusing is that you can comment on the science, but could also have provided guidelines to states and businesses on how to apply the science to these mask mandates or policies for indoor get-togethers. And I think that that's where the disconnect happened.
So the science of the vaccination, and that once people are vaccinated, that it is safe to be unmasked. So they were, was part of the motivation maybe to encourage vaccinations?
You know, the CDC says that their reason for doing this was not to motivate vaccinations, but rather they made this announcement because there were these new publications showing just how effective the vaccines are. It is true biologically, Matt, that if you have been fully vaccinated, your chance of getting infected, getting seriously ill, getting hospitalized, or God forbid, passing COVID on to someone else is really, really, really low. It's not zero. Nothing in life is zero. But the CDC felt appropriately that they should comment on that accumulating science on how good the vaccines are. But the behavioral science, of course, is the other part of it.
Yes.
How this affects what we all do, right? And that's the part that they didn't comment on.
And now in terms of what we can do, masks are not required for vaccinated people almost everywhere. But what are some of the caveats?
So the caveats, according to the CDC right now, are if you are on public transportation, if you are in a congregate living facility, so like a nursing home or a jail or a shelter, or of course, if you're in a healthcare space. So if you come to visit me in my emergency department, you will still be required to mask up.
Grocery stores?
Grocery stores, interesting. So the way that the CDC recommendations read, if you are fully vaccinated, you do not have to wear a mask anywhere else indoors. Grocery stores, movie theaters, malls, you can go unmasked.
You know, I just feel like some people might continue to wear masks, even if they're vaccinated, just as a way to model what they see as good behavior. It's almost like waiting for the walk sign, even when there aren't any cars coming. Do you think that makes sense to continue to wear masks because you just believe that there's still a threat out there and you want other people to be safe?
Yeah, Matt, I absolutely do. And I am one of those people, actually, who will keep wearing a mask at public indoor gatherings, at least for the short term. There are two reasons why. The first is what you said. It is modeling good behavior for my kids who are not vaccinated yet, as well as for those around me who aren't vaccinated. It's a way of indicating a dedication to the community rather than having life just be all about myself. And the last thing is that although our vaccine rates are great and although our COVID cases are dropping quickly, they're not yet that low. And although the vaccines are great, it's not a zero risk of catching it. So I'm going to keep the mask on until everyone who wants the vaccine, every adult who wants the vaccine, has had the chance to have it. And also now our 12 to 15 year olds, it's going to be 4 to 6 weeks until those kids are fully vaccinated. I feel like, you know, right around July 4th, that deadline that Biden had originally set, feels like a more appropriate time for us to start shedding our masks indoors.
We were talking about kids, and obviously many children are still not eligible for the vaccine. So how should we be thinking about masking around them? Should kids be masking around each other indoors? What are some guidelines here?
So as with so much else in this pandemic, there are no definitive answers. What I'm telling folks is that if kids are outdoors and doing something where they've got at least a little distance between each other, but really, honestly, if they're outdoors, they can by and large go unmasked. We know how this virus spreads and those outdoor activities, unless they're playing contact sports, are likely to be safe. Indoors, for now, they need to stay masked. At school, in social get-togethers, the kids need to be masked up. That may change as COVID rates continue to drop and as those young adolescents get vaccinated. Each vaccine that goes in the arm protects not just the individual, but also the community. And that's true for kids too. So for now, outdoors, okay to be unmasked if you've got a little space between each other. Indoors, keep the mask on the kids.
Got it. What do you make of the various mask guidance we've been getting over the last year? What does that indicate to you about the importance of just consistency when it comes to public health messaging?
You know, I think that we in public health are going to be studying the communications challenges that we faced during this pandemic for quite a while to come. You know, folks have been responding in real time to changing science, and the world isn't really used to that. Usually, public health comes out with recommendations that are based on really well done, well established evidence. We've been having to be quicker than usual. And when you're quick, sometimes the science changes. But there's a lot that we could be doing to be clearer about the communication and about the reasons behind the changes.
Before I let you go, I want to go into the future a little bit to get a sense of whether masks are always going to be with us in one way or another. So 5 years from now, God willing, there's no other pandemic between now and then. If I were to walk into a crowded New York City subway car 5 years from now, is it likely that I see at least one person with a mask?
I think masks are here to stay, at least for a portion of the population. And the biggest thing I keep telling people is that these CDC recommendations are a floor, not a ceiling. They don't force you to take your mask off. And I expect many of us will continue to wear them in crowded situations for years to come.
Very interesting. And if you're going for a walk, like if let's say you're mailing a letter later today, you're going for a walk 2 blocks away from your home, are you going to put on a mask to walk outside?
I'm not. I'm fully vaccinated. I have not been wearing a mask outside for a while.
It must be, feels liberating to not have it on outside after this.
It's
these 14
awesome.
Months, doesn't it?
It's absolutely terrific. And one quick last thing is I'm also doing get-togethers with other vaccinated people without masks. That's totally safe too. And I encourage folks to start socializing again, to start moving back towards normal. It's okay to have a little anxiety about it, but getting together with vaccinated friends is totally, totally, totally safe.
Yes, and enjoyable after all this time alone. Dr. Megan Rani is an emergency physician and associate dean of the School of Public Health at Brown University. Thanks as always for joining us, Doctor. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts. Last week, the AFL-CIO, the SEIU, and an independent Mexican labor union submitted a complaint to the United States Trade Representative under the United States-Mexico and Canada Trade Agreement, called the USMCA. The complaint alleges that Mexican workers in the northern city of Matamoros are facing aggressive union busting in violation of the trade agreement. Well, the USMCA has provisions that allow countries to investigate shady activity at specific factories and take action, a significant difference from other trade agreements. And this includes activity infringing on unionization efforts. So here to help us understand what may happen is Alex Lawson, editor-at-large at Law 360. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Matt, thanks so much for having me. Good to be on the show.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So let's first start with what's happening in the city of Matamoros in Mexico. What are we seeing taking place there?
Well, there's been a union drive at a Mexican manufacturer called Tridonex. They make auto parts there, and they are actually owned by a U.S. company that's called, I believe, Cardone. And there has been for a long time allegations that there's basically a very aggressive union busting effort going on there by management and by the local government that basically amounts to hundreds of workers being fired in retaliation for trying to organize there. And most notably, there was a Mexican labor lawyer who was helping the union drive. Her name is Susana Prieto. She was actually thrown in jail over what the union says are trumped up charges for aiding the workers union drive. So the AFL-CIO has been talking about this for well over a year, basically ever since the USMCA came into force last year, and they finally took action on it last week, making use of this new enforcement mechanism.
What did they do in terms of taking action? What does that mean?
Yeah, so as you alluded to in the intro there, the USMCA has a specific enforcement provision that is a dispute settlement provision that is only focused on labor issues. And basically, it allows any interested person, it would most often be a union, to file a petition saying, we believe that there has been a denial of collective bargaining rights or unionization rights at this specific factory in Mexico, and they can ask the government to investigate it. From there, there is sort of a very wonky flow chart situation about what may or may not happen. But the point is, it can result, I'm not saying that this is imminent, but it can result in specific trade sanctions against this facility, which is a big difference from the way that this type of stuff has been done in older agreements. Before, you could only kind of retaliate against Mexican exports generally, and this made the system a little bit unworkable. People were hesitant to use it. They thought it was a little too blunt. This is much more targeted. It's supposed to move along a quicker timeline, and the AFL-CIO and those other unions took the first step in that long process last week with the filing of a petition, basically alleging all of these things that I have laid out, what's going on at the Tridonex factory.
And the AFL-CIO is involved in this. Why? Is that just because they're a major labor union in the United States? Like, what is their standing to file this complaint?
Yeah. So it wasn't just them. As you said, there was AFL-CIO, SEIU, and a Mexican union. All of it sort of filed collectively. They have taken the lead on it because, I mean, they have advocated for an improvement in Mexican labor conditions for many years. And there's two reasons for that, really. One is just on a moral level. I mean, they are the world's largest union, and unions are all about solidarity. So they obviously, it's in their interest to, you know, promote union use worldwide, writ large. But the sort of longer term goal of improving labor conditions in Mexico is also, I mean, if they're being quite candid, is to not have U.S. workers at a disadvantage by, you know, having workers in a neighboring country getting paid, you know, meager wages with no union protections at all. That leads to companies sort of moving facilities there, taking jobs away from here. So it's that they come at it from both a moral and an economic place, I would say.
Alex, the AFL-CIO, the SEIU, an independent Mexican union submitted this complaint to the U.S. Trade Representative. What happens now? They file this complaint alleging unfair labor practices. Now what happens?
Well, it is sitting at, there's an interagency committee that's led by USTR, the U.S. Trade Representative, and they have 30 days to investigate the complaint and see if it has merit. Now, most people that you talk to agree that they will, this is a very strong case that the AFL-CIO has brought. It's the first one that tests these new rules in USMCA. So most people believe it will pass that initial review here in the coming weeks. From there, the U.S. will then ask Mexico to conduct its own review of the allegations, and Mexico can either, it can honor that request or it can not. If it becomes adversarial, it gets kicked to a panel of arbitrators, it's a three-person panel, a basic international arbitration setup, and that could set the stage for punishment, sanctions, whether it's tariffs or some other measures against the products made by this factory. Now, I will say most people agree that the more ideal outcome is not to be so punitive with it. They hope that they can remediate this through negotiation, allow a union effort to actually take place rather than have to punish them. That's seen as sort of a last resort, but that is the status. That's sort of where the petition lies right now.
What kind of damning allegations are they making in the complaint? Do they have particular evidence of specific violations?
Haven't actually seen the complaint yet, which is certainly a point of some intrigue here. They've released just sort of what reads as basically a list of, like, a bulleted list of things that they allege are going on there. Most notably, the firing of about 600 workers in retaliation for unionizing. And as I said, throwing this lawyer who is leading the drive in jail, which is obviously pretty, if true, fairly egregious anti-union activity that passes the smell test here of a denial of labor rights. But yeah, I think it's also important to note that, I mean, in the sort of long arc of U.S. history, having labor protections in trade agreements is relatively new. It kind of came in vogue the last like three decades. But critics always said they never worked how they were supposed to. And this part of the reason that the USMCA passed with bipartisan support, including from the AFL-CIO, who just as a cheat sheet here, unions never support trade agreements ever. It was a huge, huge deal that they supported this one. And the addition of this new labor mechanism that we're talking about, this new enforcement mechanism, was a huge reason for that. So there's a lot of eyeballs on this to see if the system is going to work the way its supporters said that it would.
Right. To see if it has some teeth in any way, even if it just pushes the parties to settle and to allow some degree of labor organizing in this factory.
Yeah, it's most people agree it's a very strong case. They wouldn't bring, you know, a quote unquote loser for like the vanguard case of this new enforcement mechanism. So we'll see how it goes. There's a lot of eyeballs on Mexico as well for them to, you know, accept this sort of call for an investigation in good faith. But a lot of intrigue around this one, to be sure.
So under the USMCA, can Mexico or Canada look into labor issues at American companies?
It's funny you should say that. There is a big movement sort of in the labor community among labor academics. It is technically possible for a complaint to be brought against a U.S. factory. But without getting too weedy, the scope of facilities that can be investigated is very small. It's subject to an enforced NLRB order. Any facility that's subject to an enforced NLRB order, and that's just a long way of saying that almost never really happens. That's a very small percentage of factories that are subject to orders like that. So there has been some cries of hypocrisy by labor activists, labor academics that say, like, it's basically a lot easier to investigate labor impropriety in Mexico than it is in the United States by these other countries. But this is the only document we got on the book now. So that's sort of where a lot of the attention is, how it's going to work.
Sure, sure. Since the USMCA was signed, have there been any other cases taking place in which the U.S. government was paying attention to certain conditions with Mexican facilities?
Well, this one we're talking about now that was filed by the AFL-CIO was the first actual sort of labor, the first complaint filed using this new labor enforcement system. 2 days after they did that, the U.S. Brought its own case. This was to investigate irregularities at a union vote at actually a General Motors plant in the northern Mexican city of Silao. And that obviously raised a lot of eyebrows because this is a U.S. company and it obviously has an operation in Mexico. And they have asked Mexico to review what's going on with this union vote. But this was sort of a, there was this, you know, new thing. Nothing had been filed under these rules. And then there were two complaints in the span of 3 days. So it will definitely be interesting to see how quickly the ball gets rolling down the hill here.
And how is the Mexican government reacting to this? I mean, even though this is, you know, on paper, they signed this agreement, it must feel to them a little bit like meddling.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I mean, like you say, I mean, these are rules that they signed up for. And
sure,
there were all signs in these early cases, though, point to them at least cooperating with the early phases. Now, we'll see if it gets more contentious later on and sets up the possibility of sanctions. But just because there's been so much such a bright spotlight on these on this pair of labor disputes, it would be pretty bad optics to have them sort of dig in their heels and say, no, we can house all the union busting that we want here. And I should note that in that second case that I just talked about at the General Motors facility, the Mexican Labor Ministry on its own, even before the U.S. filed its case, did suspend that vote. They also saw irregularities. So they are moving kind of in lockstep with the U.S. on that one already. And they're kind of, and the U.S. kind of brought the case, I think, just to keep a light on it. But so far, Mexico is generally playing ball on these.
Alex Lawson is an editor at large at Law 360. Alex, thanks a lot for explaining all of this to us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Do you have any experience in motion pictures?
Active renter at Blockbuster.
Can we talk about something other than Hollywood for a change?
Ms. Taken. You know Mr. Taken from the Taken movies. This is his niece.
The studio makes pictures to serve the system.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
2020 was a rough year for movie theaters. The biggest chains took major financial hits, and many beloved local theaters had to close their doors for good. But this summer, movie theaters are back, and you don't have to take my word for it. Just listen to Vin Diesel.
For more than 100 years, there's one place where we all came together to be entertained, to escape, to go someplace new. The movies. There's nothing like that moment when the lights go down. The projector ignites. And we believe.
And we eat popcorn. Now Vin Diesel has a major incentive to get people back into theater seats. The 9th installment in his Fast and Furious franchise comes out at the end of June. But more than a year into the pandemic, some people still feel uncomfortable spending hours in a dark theater with a group of strangers, and others might just prefer the ease of streaming movies at home. So, what will the coming months look like at the movies?
The movies.
Here with me now to talk about it is Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Rafer, great to have you back on the show.
Hi, Matt. How are you doing?
Doing great, thank you. So I'm not going to ask whether we need to see a 9th Fast and the Furious. I'm going to first ask whether we should be going back to the theaters. You've recently started going back in person. What's it like?
Yeah, I've done it a couple of different ways, actually. I've been a paying customer. I have done the private rental for me and my family. And I've been a critic where I've gone back to a private screening room and sat and watched an advanced screening of a movie. And I guess I would say it's wonderful to be back. You know, if you're going to a regular old theater, you know, you're going to see the same kind of differences, I think, that you're seeing everywhere else. You know, things are a lot emptier. People are keeping their distance from each other. Everyone's got a mask, you know, the usual kind of thing. But it's pretty darn nice to be back in a movie theater with that, you know, $80 popcorn on your lap and sitting there watching something on a big screen. I watched Raya the Last Dragon, the new Disney movie. I'd seen it on my computer. I gave it a so-so review. I saw it in the theaters, and I got to tell you, on the big screen, I thought, this is a lot better. This is a lot better movie seeing it on the big screen.
Was it the screen? Was it the sound? Was it the communal experience? Why was it better, do you think?
I think it's just everything. You're there with other people. You know, I was there with my kids watching that movie. My kids reacted to it a lot better. The jokes landed with them a little more than they did with me. You know, you've got that big screen that just kind of takes up your whole field of vision. I know we've all got fairly big TVs these days, but you know, you can't really replace that big screen experience, the sound that's all over you. It's so much more immersive. You're in the dark, your phone's not ringing, you know, no one's walking back and forth in front of you, you know, going back to the kitchen or doing whatever. It's just, you know, it's that movie feeling. I agree with Vin Diesel. It's where the magic happens.
What's different about theaters now? Many theaters have undergone a number of changes to comply with public health guidelines. Were you noticing any of those changes while you were inside these theaters?
You know, I think a lot of theaters have done are redoing their ventilation systems and stuff. That's the kind of thing you're probably not going to notice. That's very behind the scenes. But, you know, if you go get popcorn, you know, you're not going to be able to go pump your own butter. They're going to give it to you in a little, you know, the little tiny thing that they use for hot sauce, you know, get a little thing of that oil, which really makes you realize what you're putting on that popcorn when you can really see it. In that thing. It really gives you some second thoughts, I got to tell you.
Sure.
You know, but like though, I say, it is delicious. I can't live without it. But, you know, so some of that stuff, you know, again, you know, you can't pump your own drinks. You got to give it to somebody and that person's going to turn around and fill it up for you and then give it back to you and then give you your straw. So people are being pretty careful. Everyone's got the, you know, the gloves on. Everyone's still got their masks on indoors, of course. You know, the same as you'll notice when you go to the cafe or something and, you know, you go to the donut shop or whatever, you know, just things have changed and things are going to be different, I think, for some time to come.
Some studios like Warner Brothers and Disney are going to keep releasing their movies both in the theaters and then on streaming services simultaneously, at least for a little while. So this is like a new shift. It's a new thing. What are some of the major releases that are coming out that are getting this type of hybrid release?
Yeah, there's quite a few. So I think that the two big players in that space, I think, are just like you said, Disney and Warner Brothers. They're the ones that have really gone whole hog on this. So, for instance, Cruella, you know, the origin story of Cruella de Vil from 101 Dalmatians with Emma Stone, that's coming out May 28th. That'll also be on Disney Plus. But, you know, you got to pay extra. It's premier access. It's an extra $30 fee to see Cruella. And they're doing the same thing with Black Widow, July 9th. That's going to be in theaters, but also on Disney Plus with the premiere access. Warner Brothers is doing all this with HBO Max. In the Heights, they're going to do that way. You know, so I think all Warner Brothers movies are going to be on in theaters and on HBO Max. Disney is doing a little bit of, you know, some of these will be on Disney where you pay extra. Some of them will be on Disney where you don't pay extra. Some will be in theaters only. Disney's being a little more careful about that. Like, for instance, their big Beatles documentary from Peter Jackson, Get Back, that's out August 27th. That's a Disney movie, but that's in theaters only. Like, they want people to come out and see that one. So it kind of depends on the title.
And if you have the option to screen it at home and it's only a couple bucks, are you going to go to the theaters? I mean, you are. You will. You enjoy the experience. Do you imagine that there will be enough people to keep going to theaters even if they have the option to sit at home on the couch?
I mean, I think that's the big question for all this stuff. And for me, I think the real signpost for whether or not the movies are really back and whether they kind of still hold that place in our hearts, I think it's going to be Black Widow. Because there's a movie that's going to be in theaters, but also on premier access. And this is, you know, this is a huge movie. Scarlett Johansson, she's a massive movie star. People love her in this, the Black Widow role, you know, from the Avengers. All these other Marvel heroes have had their own standalone movies. This is her first. It's been delayed for a year. It was originally supposed to come out last May. So there's a lot of pent-up demand for this. But now you've got a choice. Are you going to stay home and pay the $30 flat fee and your whole family and maybe even your friends can all sit around and watch it in your home safely? Or do you go out to the movies, pay the $15 per person, pay that extra premium for the popcorn, the Coke, and the M&Ms? Will people go out and do that? Will they make the choice? And I think that'll be really interesting. If people stay home or just wait for that to come on video, that's going to be a troubling sign. But if they get out and go see it, then I really feel like, hey, the movies are back.
Wow, interesting. No, until I can figure out how to make that butter concoction myself at home, I think I'll have to continue to go to the theaters. Rafer Guzman is the film critic for Newsday. Rafer, thanks so much. Enjoy the films.
Thanks, Matt.
That's all we have for you folks today. It's always a pleasure being here with you. Call us with your ideas or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also find me at MattKatz00. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz in all week for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.